The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
It's a pleasure to have Dr. Robert W. Malone, MD, on, and he is co-author of PsyWar, Enforcing the New World Order. And, Doctor, it is great to have you on. Good morning, sir.
Thanks for having me on, Bill. How are you doing there in Oregon?
Doing pretty well right now, other than just waving through the propaganda like everybody else, like probably like you do on a daily basis here. I'm looking at your business card must be about an 8.5 by 11 sheet piece of paper, because I'm looking at this.
Read it all or we'll blow the whole head.
Okay. All right. We won't do that then. He knew where I was going to go, right? But anyway, of course, big on virology and, of course, a huge brain with this one. You know, listen,
and clinical research and regulatory affairs, and all that stuff.
Yeah. mRNA and all the rest of it. And the talk right now is that everybody is just having a hissy fit over bird flu. And you as a virologist, Dr. Malone.
And Ebola is waiting in the wings. They want to spin that one up, too.
Oh, okay. They want to spin this one up? They want to, you think?
Yeah. There was a case in New York, I think, or something like that. Somebody coming across from Africa. And so now they're beating the drum about Ebola fear.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe this will play into PsyWar, and we'll get to that here in just a moment. But let me take it back to bird flu. How serious? They're calling herds. Eggs are, $10 a dozen in some cases, that sort of thing. Should the birds be inoculated? And what is your take as a virologist?
So, down to basics, anytime you encounter a new kind of wave of propaganda, because that's what we're dealing with, I call it psychological bioterrorism.
Oh.
And it's following the standard script. This is about the fourth or fifth time we've had a go-around with fear around bird flu. It gets reactivated periodically. Anytime you hear this kind of stuff, you've got two key questions. Are people dying and being hospitalized on a regular basis? And is there evidence of human-to-human transmission, efficient human-to-human transmission? And the answer to both of those with bird flu is no. Even the CDC says that the human risk of bird flu is low. Okay, so park that one.
Okay.
Now, the question of should we be inoculating poultry flocks with influenza vaccine, which now has been authorized, I think, by the USDA. There's a couple of things about that. Number one, just right out of the box, that will make it so that none of those birds can be exported. And that matters if you're somebody who is in the chicken business or the duck business or the turkey business. Number two, bird flu has been endemic for decades, and it continues to be endemic in wild bird populations, particularly ducks and geese and migratory waterfowl. There is no way that you can eliminate bird flu because it has a natural reservoir. Here's the thing. If a three-year-old gets a hammer, everything becomes a nail approach to infectious disease management, which is to say all infectious disease needs to be managed with a vaccine. That's kind of the way that they think in D.C., and of course it's good business. The problem is that influenza comes around again and again and again because of certain properties of the influenza virus. We don't become permanently immune to influenza, unlike measles. You get it once and you're done, one and done. Not true with flu, and by the way, not true with coronaviruses. And so we have no, here's some fancy words, sterilizing vaccines. That means a vaccine that will prevent you from getting infected, having the virus replicate, and you spread it to others. There are no sterilizing vaccines.
So for flu, you just have to throw some vaccine at it that you modify, that you think will attack that particular one?
It's in the case of the birds, what's going to happen if you start vaccinating them is two things. Number one, you will probably reduce the severity of the disease in the birds. What that means is the humans, because this is the real issue, is bird-to-human transmission. Humans that are interacting with these birds in these massive flocks are not going to be aware that they're sick. And so they're going to not be using protective gear, and they're going to be exposed to much more of this virus than they would be if the birds actually showed disease.
Oh.
That's kind of what's happening in the cattle population, particularly milk cows. That's exactly what's happening. And the other thing is that if you have the technical term is leaky vaccine, that's one that's less than 100% effective, what you will end up doing is selecting for influenza virus that is vaccine resistant. That's what will happen. So you'll basically breed super virus, and then that's even more of a threat to human beings. But that's the way this kind of stupid, misguided policy is leading, is that they are going to force the breeding of more resistant influenza viruses. This is why worldwide there's consensus you can't vaccinate poultry flocks for flu. It is a stupid policy. Now, what you can do is instead of killing the whole flock, the chicken barn or the entire farm, once you get an infection, and you're going to get infections because it's endemic in all the outside birds,
okay,
which means it's in the water and everything else. Okay, what you can do is treat each one of these outbreaks like an experiment, because it doesn't kill all the chickens. The only thing that kills all the chickens is the people that the USDA send in there to kill all the chickens. The bird flu does not kill all the chickens. So if you let the bird flu move through a flock and treat it like an experiment, what you're going to end up with is something like 20 to 30% of the chickens are going to survive, and they're going to be more resistant to bird flu. And there's something about them or their genetics, and you can start breeding flocks that are going to be resistant to bird flu. That's the only way out of this.
You would use this then as the opportunity to build a stronger bird flock rather than killing all the birds with bird flu.
It is the only option here, okay, is to select for. Remember, these birds are highly selected. They are owned by the people that own, you know, like Tyson's chickens, okay? The people that are managing these flocks are put into a contract where they have to use the feed that comes from the big corp. They have to use the chicks that come from the big corp. And they basically sit there and turn the crank and do what they're told. And so these are highly genetically selected flocks. And they just have to be enabled to do the selection for bird flu resistant flocks. And then we will be out of the problem, and it'll take a year maybe, because chickens reproduce really fast.
That sounds like a really good way of going. Do you think we could expect that out of the current FDA
Absolutely
or the USDA?
Not.
Because, all right.
Because the government, the White House has hired this guy, Jerry Parker, DVM. He's like associate dean for One Health from Texas A&M. And Jerry is all in on the conventional wisdom that you have to jab your way out of an infectious disease outbreak.
Oh,
one of his best buddies is Peter Hotez.
That says a lot, then. Dr. Malone, by the way, let's shift gears here. I think you did a pretty good job of explaining whether or not to inoculate or vaccinate into the bird flu pandemic, okay?
Into the mouth of a pandemic, you can never vaccinate your way out.
Yep, you were very much on the record for that, even back in COVID time, which arguably, when you look back at that time, and I think it's still continuing, psychological war, which brings us to your book, Psy War, Enforcing the New World Order. Now, you co-wrote this with your wife, Dr. Jill Glasspool Malone. And what were you hoping, or what are you hoping to get out there? And part of me was wondering, I just started reading the book the other day, just got a copy of it. And I'm kind of curious if the concern right now is that we may even go to sleep. Let's say you are a Trump supporter and you're happy that the new administration came in. I'm just curious if there's a concern that we go to sleep with continuing psychological war going against the people. How do you see it?
Of course, that's a concern. Politicians and governments have used propaganda, and PsyWar is just the most advanced modern toolkit for propaganda and censorship in the internet age. That's all it is. But it is incredibly powerful. But governments have always used this. If you go back to Sun Tzu and the Art of War, a lot of that's about propaganda. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to imagine, despite their, you know, best intentions, that this will completely stop under the Trump administration. Now, talking about getting back to kind of this infectious disease psychological manipulation, I call this psychological bioterrorism. And there's a former Russian KGB agent that was a specialist in this area. He called it information bioterrorism. And he laid out a series of steps that's used, standard spycraft, to basically heat an infectious disease fear cycle and then weaponize it for a variety of different purposes. Frankly, I think that pharma has learned to use psychological bioterrorism and this method that the intelligence community used for years to disrupt economies and all kinds of things. I think they've learned to use that for marketing. I think that's what we're seeing right now, personally. That's speculation. It's covered in Chapter 4. Which is about psychological bioterrorism. So that's one to read that is absolutely built around bird flu, and it's based on an interview that this former Russian agent gave in a New Zealand journal in 2017, and he was specifically talking about bird flu in 2017, and yet he laid out a series of steps that precisely parallel what happened during COVID. And if you read it, you'll recognize all of these things are happening with bird flu right now. But there's so much more in that book. The intention of the book is to, you know, if we want to stay with the vaccine metaphor, to inoculate the reader so that they understand the technology and the methods that are being deployed against them to try to control everything that they're thinking and feeling and believing. And the tech is really powerful. And if you think you're educated and therefore you're resistant to it, think again, because the highly educated are among the most susceptible to this tech.
Why are the most highly educated more willing to go along with the tech? In fact, you actually have a techno-totalitarianism is what you term it. Why do they tend to go along with that?
So there's a number of reasons. Remember that the process of higher education, particularly medical higher education, by the way, is one in which you are taught to obey authority. You are taught to assimilate what you are being told as truth.
Isn't that essentially the entire American public school education system, though, too?
And universities.
Okay.
So absolutely, we are basically indoctrinated into not thinking for yourself, but accepting the truth, quote unquote, that is being told to us or taught to us by authority figures. And so therefore, when an authority figure and their surrogates, corporate media, stand up and tell us this is truth, we're basically trained to accept that. Now, what's interesting is if you look back at what happened during COVID, a lot of the community that were skeptics were people that were, the phrase that's used, and we talk about this in the book also, they're physicals as opposed to virtuals. They're the folks that actually do stuff with their hands. They do physical labor. They're the tradesmen, et cetera.
They were the ones who were considered non-essential workers in many cases, too.
True. But these are the ones that were least susceptible to this. And part of it is that they live in a world that is very tangible, very real. They don't believe things that they can't see, feel, hear, or otherwise directly perceive. They're very much more resistant to the propaganda, whereas the virtuals, you know, the most notable example of virtuals are the coders or the people that live online or are totally harnessed to their cell phones. And the financial community, these people, you know, they're in Oregon, you're right next door to Virtual Central in Seattle, Washington. And these are people that live in a world in which the belief is that reality is whatever you believe it to be. because that's the world they live in, that reality is something that's very fluid and plastic. It can be manipulated. You know, we have this language of non-player characters. They live in video game land.
It's an avatar world. In other words, an avatar worldview. Right?
Well put. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they live in an avatar world, and they believe that truth is whatever they believe it to be. That gets to the logic behind the transsexualism and the gender fluidity and all these things that are all grounded in the belief that there is no objective reality. Reality is subjective. It's whatever you feel it to be. And these people are super susceptible to this kind of manipulation tech.
Dr. Malone, how close were we, in your opinion, to losing the Republic, I think, over the COVID time in which, you know, we went down a pretty dark place? You were
personally
part of that.
Personally, I think we were one election away. You know, we now, the big reveal, and one that I didn't anticipate in the book, when we were writing the book a year and a half ago, Jill and I, we were perplexed by the question that came at us all the time, who is the puppet master?
Right.
And we had traveled all over the world, and we saw the harmonization of messaging globally, particularly in the Western nations, down to the letter of, you know, I was once accused in the Italian press of being one of the disinformation dozen, a term that was originally weaponized in the American press. And unfortunately, they only named eight of us, so I guess eight is a dozen in Italy. I guess that's a form of inflation. But in any case, the same language, the same strategies were used all over the world. And I was perplexed. What organization is big enough and powerful enough to do that globally? And the only one that I could think of was the CIA. But now we know, thanks to Elon Musk and Doge, that it was USAID doing this. Mm-hmm. USAID has put out money to sponsor, quote, journalists and journalist training all over the Western world and use them for regime change and narrative control, et cetera. Now, the case is made, and I think it's really bolstered by this new information, that USAID, as Mike Benz put it, USAID does all the stuff that's too dirty for the CIA to do. USAID has absolutely been functioning as a surrogate for both the State Department and the CIA, and seems to have been central to all this global messaging and information manipulation that we experienced during COVID and is ongoing. The question is now, by defunding them, remember that those funds are already encumbered. So even if they shut down USAID today, those grants and contracts are going to continue rolling for the next year or two, and the Trump administration is going to continue to have to deal with the consequences. And boy, are there consequences. Right now, you look at corporate media, and it's as if DOGE doesn't exist. The things that are being uncovered are hardly being covered in any of the standard outlets. CBS News is basically, in addition to NPR, is an arm of the Democrat Party. It's, you know, and of course CNN. We're seeing this roll on a daily basis, and yet, as Elon Musk says, you are the new media. We are in a position where this is all being transformed, and what comes out the other side of that sausage making, I have no idea.
What do you believe RFK Jr.'s biggest challenge will be, and where do you think he will be most effective at reforming America's health policy, I guess you might call it that?
His challenge is that he is already being ring-fenced by second- and third-tier appointments, as well as the senior executive service, that have obeisance to Big Pharma.
Oh, boy.
That is already in play. And unfortunately, he kind of got bushwhacked while he was busy being focused on getting confirmed. And a bunch of people like Jerry Parker were put in positions of power. So he's somehow, you know, he's basically, he knows that he has landed in a den of snakes. And somehow he's got to navigate that. You know, God bless him. And he's going to need all the intelligence and advisors that he can possibly get his hands on. Nicole Shanahan is his advisor. Callie Means is his advisor. He's pulling together a team around him to help him navigate this cesspool. But that's going to be tough. What is he going to focus on? We already know the outlines have been provided, and in particular in the new executive order that relates to the creation of the MAHA Commission. So you can find that, look it up. And what you'll see is that absolutely there is a focus on trying to transition HHS and the federal government from a disease-centric model, which is what pharma favors, to a health and health promotion-centric model, which is a radical shift. It sounds like a small thing. It's enormous lift. Because so, NIH, CDC, FDA are all structured around disease. The other thing that that presidential directive demonstrates is the focus is particularly on children, on child health, on chronic disease in children, including autism, and stopping the overuse, overprescription of various drugs like Ritalin that are basically making our kids into zombies.
I just wanted to make sure, Doctor, that that we drill in here before we take off then. If you were to give a percentage, how much of RFK Jr. has already been neutered? If you were to venture a guess on, this was my concern. I was wondering how many people would be surrounded to keep him in his place, so to speak. What would you say?
Right now, in the kind of DC insider world, there's a lot of discussion about that. And I think the jury's still out because Bobby Kennedy is a smart cookie. Mm-hmm. And he knows that he's being bushwhacked.
And he only has one shot at this job. This is probably going to be it.
He's got at best 2 years, but Donald Trump has told him that he has to show measurable improvements in the health of American citizens within 12 to 18 months. That is a heavy, heavy lift. So how much has he been surrounded by, deep state or entrenched bureaucracy that is not very willing to go along with this new agenda? You know, it might be 80 or 90% at this point.
Wow.
And the other ones are, it's been really hard to find appointees that are sophisticated in the nefarious ways of DC and backing major change of the type that Bobby is advocating.
Because the money is behind, vaccines are health, and, health comes from fighting disease, right?
That is the standard group think. Mm-hmm. And so it's been really hard finding people that are willing to, rethink things, come up with novel ideas, and buck the system. Consequently, a number of the people that have been put into positions right now of leadership are relatively inexperienced in the nefarious ways of DC. And so they have to be backstopped by chief of staff people and senior executive service people, et cetera, that understand how DC works in order to try to get this agenda pushed through. And of course, those people are often very invested in the way things are right now. And so it's a paradox. And I don't know how it's going to resolve itself. It's going to take enormous force of will and focus. And I wish Bobby and his senior leadership the best. It's going to be a challenge for Jay Bhattacharya and the directors of CDC and the new commissioner at the FDA. There's a long history of the bureaucracy slow walking and being passive aggressive and very resistant to change. And I think I've said this now for months, the real weapon of change is DOGE.
Well, from your lips here, Doctor, final question I have for you. And by the way, the new book is Cywar, Enforcing the New World Order by Dr. Robert W. Malone, M.D. We'll put all his information up on my blog today. But what I want to ask you about the medical world, in your own industry, your own trade then, will doctors ever be allowed or pushed to start practicing medicine again rather than practicing hospital protocols, which seems to be where we suffer right now?
hospital and government protocols that are backed by the insurers.
Yes.
I mean, that whole complex is basically taken over the practice of medicine, and the practice of medicine has also been taken over by, quote, public health, which is fundamentally socialist. It seeks the optimized outcome for public health rather than providing equality of access and information about how to be healthy and letting people make their own choices. It's a top-down solution, and they pushed it all the way down so that physicians basically now are technicians implementing policies and protocols that are coming from above. And there is a movement for people to seek out particularly primary care physicians and engage in alternative strategies, often not insurance-based, or alternative medical, things like health savings accounts, et cetera.
Direct primary care, I would imagine.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And so I advocate that we have to move back to what's called the principle of subsidiarity, that decisions should be made at the lowest competent level. And in healthcare, that is the physician-patient relationship. I think we have to migrate to a position where people are empowered to make their own healthcare decisions and encouraged to do so together with medical care providers who act more like coaches and enablers rather than, big brother telling you what you have to do and what vaccines your children have to take, et cetera, et cetera. That is going to take some time, but it's something that can already be done by your listeners. They can seek out primary care physicians that aren't buying into the system. And they're hard to find. They're often the same ones that would prescribe these alternative COVID treatments that we could talk about, but they're very censored. Those are the ones that are out there at the front lines of bringing medicine and medical care back to the people. And I'm basically a libertarian. As I like to say, we shouldn't be telling people what they have to eat. We should be informing them about the risks, and we should be reducing toxins from the food supply and highly processed foods. But if the president of the United States wants to eat McDonald's and drink Coca-Cola, God bless him, he should have the right to do so, right?
And should not be told no. But there are, there's no perfection. There's only choices. There are choices, and there are always ramifications of choices we make.
We need to empower people to make their own choices. Now, the nuance here is, for instance, the SNAP program, where there are new movements now for the food stamps to stop subsidizing highly processed foods. That's a different thing. When the government is paying for assistance, food assistance, which means you and I are, then I think we've got the right to say, no, you can't use this money to buy junk food that's just going to make you sicker.
Yeah, you're not going to use it to buy Fritos, as an example. You're going to use it to purchase good proteins and good healthy starches, things like that, vegetables and
kits mm-hmm. to bake corn muffins or whatever instead of Fritos. But, you get the point.
Absolutely. Doctor, a pleasure talking with you this morning. And like I said, I just started reading Cywar, Enforcing the New World Order. And I'm eagerly going to devour the rest of it. And I hope to have you back someday. We wish you well. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Cywar, Enforcing the New World Order. I'll put all of Dr. Malone's information up. In fact, you can even go to his main website, which is rwmalonemd.com. Join his Substack on medicine and so much more. It is 7:39 at KMED, 99.3 KBXG.
Hi, it's John at Wellburn's Weapons. The only thing better than shooting is shooting with a suppressor.
Bullock Road in Medford.
Hi, I'm Lamont from Orleans, and I'm on 106.7 KMED.
And we appreciate you listening wherever you happen to be on KMED.com, where you can just stream directly out of the website. 105.9 in Grants Pass, 99.3 for my show during the morning on KBXG, 106.7 for South Jackson County, and of course 106.3 in the bulk of Jackson County, all right? Josephine County, former Josephine County Commissioner and former State Senator Herman Bertschinger. We always like to kick around politics and more here. And Doe's certainly top of the fold this morning. How you doing this morning, Herman? Welcome back. What'd you think of that Malone talk, Robert Malone, Dr. Malone talking about?
Well, he's always an interesting guy, you know, to listen to. And a lot of what he has to say is just kind of common sense, Bill.
Yeah, you would think so. My concern, though, is that he said that, you know, Doge really is the linchpin of what we're dealing with right now. This is where we find out just how badly we've been getting ripped off for forever, from the looks of it, I suppose. But what did concern me was when he says that, in his opinion, RFK Jr. is likely already 90% neutered, is what a term that he was looking at, you know, right now. And I hope he's wrong about that, but I'm sure that RFK Jr. probably has figured this out. And we'll likely find a way to squirm around the people that don't care for him too much. We'll see.
Well, unless there's a great purge in those people that work under him, you know, who knows? You know, what's going on is plowing all new ground. It really is. Mm-hmm. This is an absolute different way of taking over, you know, as one administration leaves and the other administration comes in. I don't think we've ever seen anything as vibrant, maybe, as what's going on now.
Yeah. Yeah, I really have to admire the tech bros in this particular situation. And yet, I don't always trust the tech bros all that much either, because I know that there are other untalked about agendas in play. I have no doubt that Elon Musk is really hoping to get rid of a lot of waste in the government, because ultimately, he wants to free up cash to go to Mars. You know, that's his thing, right? You know, he's openly talked about that for quite some time. And if you have 60 million people on Social Security who are over the age of 120, there's a problem, right? You know, you're not going to get to do stuff like that.
Right, right. Everybody's got a little dog in the fight. I mean, there's no question about it. But I will tell you, exposing... What's fascinating to me is when they expose this stuff, you hear our liberal friends go absolutely berserk, but yet they're the same ones that we've heard year after year about transparency, mm-hmm. democracy. And so now they're being about as transparent as I've ever seen the federal government being. And the democracy about it is just that. It's opening up, shining the light on this, and let people weigh in. That's the democracy. And yet they're opposed to it now.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. Do you think it's because, of course, I know that there have been some leftist liberals within the system that have talked about, that have conceded that this is the sort of stuff that we should have been doing. I know there have been people been openly saying that. There's few and far between, but there have been some intellectually honest ones that are saying, hey, listen, we should have been doing this a long time ago.
Well, this is going to be the issue that keeps on giving through this entire Trump administration, because there's so much to look at. So it is, in my opinion, it's brilliant that this administration is doing this. Because it's never going to go away. There's just so much material to look at. And I think the next shoe to drop, and you know, I don't want to convict anybody, but you do have to wonder how all these long-serving senators and U.S. Congress people have these huge net worths.
And by the way, this is not just Democrats. This is a bipartisan issue, really.
Yeah.
In
You're
D.C.
absolutely right. There's going to be some. So, you know, I mean.
Yeah, well, they come into Congress poor as a church mouse, or just, you know, of modest means, and they walk out with, a $40, $50 million net worth, right? And you can't help but wonder, well, why? Why did this happen?
Yeah,
how does this happen?
So I don't think anybody at this time is accusing, but they're asking the questions, and those individuals should have a good explanation.
Mm-hmm.
So we will see, but I think that's the next shoe to drop. And it's not just the serving senators, and it's people. There's people in the bureaucracies. that have huge net worths, and how did they get that? I mean, there might be a legitimate reason, mm-hmm. but I think they should know. Now look at us, okay? We have to disclose, and they have to disclose. When you're serving, I have to fill out a report every year, all the things I own and everything, through my SAL report. And, it answers a lot of those questions. So maybe there's some very good answers, but at the end, we want to know what are the answers.
Yeah, it's like I know that people were making a big deal about Samantha Powers over at USAID. You know her, one of the people, deeply involved, implanted there. And how much, what a high net worth she has. And you find out that from what I've read, some reports were talking about how she had a big inheritance. It's like, okay, perfectly fine explanation when you see things like that. That's reasonable, right? You get an inheritance. Mom and Dad, you get it the old-fashioned way, right?
Yep. Some people are able to draw that lottery ticket, and others of us are not.
Yeah. I am not. I just want to be on the record on something like that.
Right.
But, how do you think ultimately, having been in the state legislature, in the Senate, in the Senate and also the state house at some point, how much damage, when I say damage, I'm talking about damage to the agenda may be occurring because of this attack on the agencies and kind of the autopilot money machine that so much of the United States of America federal system and its relationship with the state governments has been on for quite some time. What does your gut tell you, Herman?
Well, I think what's happening is people are auditing both sides of the ledger. Historically, we've only audited the income side of the ledger, and mm-hmm. it's always, we need more money, we need more money, we need more money. But now people are starting to look, how is it being spent? Why do we always need money? How's it being spent? And one of the biggest examples in Oregon that I think you're going to see in the next few months is ODOT.
Thank you for bringing that up, because I've tried to figure out how can an agency that has 5,000 people working for it that builds no new freeways be continually busy and or broke all the time? Is it just me, or am I wrong in that kind of assumption? It seems to always be out of money.
Now, some of the conversations I had in the Capitol last week when I was up there was over ODOT.
Yeah.
And some of the numbers I heard, which I have not audited, so sometimes I get a little leery about just throwing figures out there. But, it seems one of them was they spent $10 million on implementing DEI,
That's $10 million that doesn't lay any asphalt or concrete anyplace, right?
Right. And I don't, I always get a little nervous when I throw those numbers out that I haven't audited. But anyways, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, now, when I was in there, we passed the transportation package, which I voted no, and that increased gas taxes every single year, and this is the last year of that, and now they're starting all over. They say, we got to have another transportation package because we need more money. So when we passed the last transportation package, that was supposed to be the fix for ODOT. And now it's finally implemented after all these years, and now we need another fix again.
Isn't part of that, though, to be fair, isn't part of that, though, due to the fact that inflation roared through the economy much more than perhaps was predicted back when your transportation package got put in, when you were in the legislature?
But you bring up some good questions. We're not building roads anymore. We're just maintaining them.
Mm-hmm.
So what is going on? And so we got to start looking at both sides of the ledger because, Bill, people cannot keep reaching into their pocket. It's just whether it's inflation or not, if you don't have the money, you don't have the money, mm-hmm. period.
Hey, Herman.
I keep screaming about the national debt, which is approaching $37 trillion. And now the smart people, the economists are saying, there is a tipping point. It's between $40 and $47 trillion,
and we're rapidly approaching that right now.
Right, and so what does that mean? The tipping point. That means the interest of the debt and the mandated programs that we have to provide will exceed the entire amount of money the federal government takes in. Hmm.
So looking at this, and it's just a math problem, Herman, right? It's just math. It's just numbers. You can't fudge the numbers really to any great extent here. This is probably one of the reasons why the state government seems to be so rabid about filing lawsuits against the Trump administration right now, especially with DOGE, because they have to be seeing a lot of those transfer payments disappearing or being seriously reduced, and that's about a third of the Oregon budget. Would that be a fair theory on why there is such anger, other than the fact that they hate the guy, I guess?
Well, that's part of it. The other part of it is just trying to obstruct every single which way you can, mm-hmm. hang on for 4 years and then take control again.
Yeah, we'll get back to normal, and DOGE goes away, and we'll start funding USAID, hire people back, et cetera, you know, that kind of thing. Before we leave here briefly, it appears that the wildfire risk map has been put on pause, at least for what it comes to going through the whole appeals process until the end of the legislative session. To me, that reads that it's going to die, I think. Is it realistic to think that's the only reason that the governor would pause that at this point?
Yes, I would continue to employ people to continue with filing their appeals process.
Because we don't know. I mean, we know the Republicans are trying to get it repealed, like Noah Robinson's bill and such like that. But that's a high risk. That's a high risk and a high lift, you know?
Yeah, I don't think repealing 762 is in the cards, but I think some major adjustments. I was at the Capitol last week for a couple of days, mm-hmm. had some very good conversations, and we talked about some very good ideas of how to accomplish. So the fundamental goal of 762 was to reduce the spread of wildfire on private lands in Oregon.
And in theory, there's nothing wrong with that point of view from the state. You can see why the state would want to do something like that. Makes sense, right? Common sense.
Right. So as a legislator, how do you do that, you know? And I would prefer to take a carrot approach, and 762 kind of takes a stick approach, you know?
Oh, yeah. 762 is just beating to death everybody who owns, owns property in the rural lands. And by the way, and I'm wondering if maybe this is going to be the death knell for it in some form, or it's not going to be what we think it is right now, because I think this is more bipartisan opposition than they might think. What do you think about that overall? There's more bipartisan. Well, I don't think it's not just Republicans that live on rural lands, or is it?
No. But, you know, then what happens is just, the 30,000 foot view is, you know, to try to reduce the spread of wildfires on private properties. That's reducing the fuel load. Mm-hmm. And so that's the overall. Then you get the environmentalists say, hey, this is a great bill. We can start, you know, their view. 1,000 Friends of Oregon, the environmental community is like, hey, we got to depopulate rural Oregon.
Right.
This is another good way of you know, nibbling around the edges.
Another tool in the sustainable development toolkit, right? That kind of thing.
Exactly. So then you get all this going on. But then, you know, then I get people that say, well, the government, you know, it's going to cost me $20,000. To reduce the fuel loading on my property, and the government ought to get grant. And then I turn around and say, as a Republican, why should government pay to clean up your property?
That's true. You know, yeah. You being a responsible property owner should be building that into your cost of ownership, right?
Right. So I think that that the discussion about reducing the risk of spread. Listen, you're never going to eliminate it, Bill. Mm-hmm. Okay, anybody who thinks you're going to eliminate the spread of wildfire on private property in Oregon are sadly mistaken. So I think it's about education. I think it's about working with insurance companies and creating programs that incentivize people to clean up their properties. And you're still going to have some people that don't. It's just that simple. You're never going to get to 100%.
Yeah.
So hopefully, hopefully we will start migrating to that because people are mad. There is a big uprising, and the appeals are, you know, people that are appealing this, that is making a difference.
Yeah, so keep it up. In other words, keep filing those appeals, notices of appeal. They need to say that grand opposition to what's going on, big citizen, broad-based citizen opposition.
Email your legislators, do all of those things.
All right. Herman, always a good talk. We'll catch you next Tuesday, all right? You be well. Take care.
Sounds good, Bill.
All right.
See you then.
Former State Senator Herman Bertschinger. It's a minute after 8. This is KMED and KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KBXG, Grants Pass, here on The Bill Meyer Show.
Do you have an electrical checklist at your house that needs...
Talk News Talk 106.3 KMED.
This is News Talk 106.3 KMED, and you're waking up with The Bill Meyer Show.
Bob Hart. How are you doing this morning, retired land use planner? Hey, what do you think about the issue here with Governor Kotek putting the administrative moves, or at least putting a pause on this temporarily, huh? What are you thinking on the wildfire map issue here?
Yeah, two things. One is we're getting to the legislature in Salem that something needs to be done, but being the conspiracy theorist, I'm thinking that this is just something to try and get people lulled into a false sense of security.
I would agree with you, especially on that part. Is why you cannot just kind of go to sleep and think, hey, I don't have to get my appeal in for my land, right?
Right. We've got to have the appeals in, and the more the better. Tonight we're having another one of the town halls in Merlin at the Community Baptist Church, 361 Merlin Road, for people to get really understanding what this whole program does. And we're going to bring some examples so people can use them for their appeals. And we're going to do one Thursday at Illinois Valley High School at 6 o'clock.
All right.
And that's not counting the rally that we're going to have in Salem next Tuesday.
And what is that? Is that going to be kind of like one of those Timber Unity kind of rallies that happened a few years ago?
Yeah, we'll be on the steps of the Capitol. We'll have speakers there to talk about the whole program and what's going on.
Yeah, I would agree with you that I think that part of this putting a pause on it is to, well, on one hand, signaling that there are problems with it. There are certainly problems with the fire map. They know there's a lot of incoming on this one. But I think that part of it is hoping people will go to sleep and not file their appeals. I really do think that's what they're thinking.
Yeah, because I know a lot of people went to sleep after the first map was withdrawn, and everybody thought it went away. And then when it came back again, they go, why do we have this? And you go, well, it was just a chance to retool and try and hit you harder and make it more bulletproof from the people.
All right. Hey, Bob, thanks for the update, and thanks for sharing the talk about the those meetings, too, all right? 770-5633. Let me grab next line. Hi, good morning. This is Bill. Who's this? Hello?
Are you there?
Yeah, I am. Who's this?
It's Mr. Colby Olson.
Oh, hey, Colby. How you doing? What's going on?
There's a lot of interesting things going on. There's groups that always pop up, and you and I both know that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the groups showed me a realty app that will give you your actual fire, quote unquote, 30-year prediction.
Mm-hmm.
26% is extreme.
Okay.
Across from a fire department and a fire chief.
Okay.
So I can look out my back sliding glass door from my chair by my fireplace, and I can see my fire chief's truck sitting there. I can walk 2 feet and see the fire department, and I am extreme.
Well, maybe when they talk about extreme, they still talk about extreme risk. Not that if there is the fire, if a fire breaks out in your neighborhood, that it wouldn't be put out. Maybe that's how they're looking at it, you know, kind of mincing or, you know, slicing and dicing the term extreme. What is the risk? What does the risk actually mean, right?
Well, it doesn't, none of it makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm used to seeing a Dodge Diesel sitting in the fire chief's driveway. I can look at my window right now, and you know where it's not at? He gave up his possession.
Where's it what now? I'm sorry.
He gave up his position.
Oh, he gave up the position. Okay. All right.
And he's been the fire chief for a year and a half.
Are you reading some interesting insight from that or what?
To me, it's very interesting. I'm like, okay, so the guy that lives across the street from me who's been the fire chief for a year and a half, who does all the work, isn't going to the firehouse anymore. He stopped.
Maybe they don't feel supported?
Right after those letters came out.
Oh, right after the letters came out. Oh. Okay, now see, that's kind of conspiracy theory Thursday-ish. Not pebbling your shoe.
It is. It very is. But legitimately, he had a beautiful Dodge Ram with all the lights and the good fire stuff, and he's a great guy.
Hey, maybe it's, Colby, maybe it's as simple as I'm getting out while the getting's good. How about that?
Well, I mean, something. It's a volunteer position out here, Azalea.
Oh, okay. Well, if it's volunteer, that certainly may explain it then. I'll tell you what. Hey, Colby, are you going to do your appeal, though? Have you done that yet?
Not yet.
Okay, please do. Don't go to sleep on that, because I'm sure that's what Governor Kotek would like everybody to do. All right. Hey, I got to roll, but thank you for the call. Good hearing from you again. 10 minutes after 8, we'll catch up on some other news here, and then we're going to switch over to pipelines here for a little bit on Pebble in Your Shoe Tuesday. Glenn Archambault, standing by.